Better late than never.
No. We're out there getting you some Twinkies?
Yes, indeed. Yes,
indeed. Some ding dong.
Hey, guys.
Steve, Tim.
Howdy.
Steve Rothschild. How are you?
Hey, did we agree on anything in terms of who's going first?
They said you were.
I am going first, but I...
the questions.
I'll just ask your questions, and you guys go for it.
Sure.
Sounds good.
How's this? Just try to look pretty.
Our next... panel, and I'll start talking so they can come on in while I'm talking, deals with labor relations, successes and disasters. And speaking of train wrecks, the first speaker to my right, Steve Bennett, has been working on the Hostess Brands case. He's with Jones Day, and you know, there's a Twinkie in everybody's life, I suspect. And and Steve also worked on Chemtura on the plan, and then he worked on Sempra Energy in the successful completion of that affiliate's bankruptcy. He's the chair of the Jones Day e-discovery committee, which is something we all should be concerned with, since none of us are immune to having everything we put in our emails discovered these days. Asked some generals about that. And he also co-founded the Sedona Conference Working Group on International E-Discovery. Also on the panel with him, we have Robert Katz, who for more than 25 years has worked in this area. Robert works with public and private middle market companies, both in and out of bankruptcy, frequently as the chief financial officer or chief restructuring officer. He was the financial reporting manager for Franklin Mint, and in Bally's, Park Place, Golden Nugget, that one. He was also an analyst there. He was with BDO Seedman for a time. He was the distribution trustee for Metaldyne, and has had a number of interesting assignments, including the Philadelphia Orchestra. Lorenzo Mendizabal, did I get it right the second time, right?
Second one.
Second one, okay. Has come to us from Epic Systems. Prior to that, he was president of Trumbull, where he oversaw the claims administration process in many cases. Most of the national ones that you've heard of that we've talked about today, Kmart, Armstrong, Mid-Valley, also known as Halliburton, Pittsburgh Corning, Quigley, J. Peterman, remember that one, WCI, Wallace and Gale, Huffy Corporation, Trump Hotels and Casino, Combustion Engineering, and a bunch of others. And we have, who else do we?
Tim Turk.
Tim Turk. Tim, when I see you, I think automobiles.
Well, you're right. I practiced in Detroit for about 10 years.
Yeah, and Tim is with Conway McKenzie. And whenever I see him, I think, that's the guy with the auto parts. And he has extensive experience in cases up to maybe $3 billion. And before automobiles were, and the GM and Chrysler cases were fashionable, this guy was there. Prior to Conway McKenzie, he was with managing director of BBK, where he had over 100 complex restructuring cases. He has actually run automobile manufacturing parts companies, probably has more bare knuckles labor experience than he would like to talk about. So, Steve, I think I'll give it to you.
Are we starting with you?
Well, we figured we'd cover. We have five areas to cover in 45 minutes. So the first is we'll cover the essential steps in analyzing restructuring employee relations in distressed entities. What are the highest priority considerations? And Steve, we'll start with you, and I guess we'll all comment on what we think about what's going on in Twinkies. So.
Well, the Hostess bankruptcy is an example of how best laid plans basically can go awry. Hostess, as you may know, actually was in bankruptcy just 3-4 years ago that it came out originally, and did not do a complete job of solving its labor problems, specifically pension and benefits. And so the second bankruptcy has focused on that issue. We got a deal with the Teamsters, did not end up getting a deal with the Bakers, and it looks like we're off the cliff into an complete lack of restructuring. It's not going to be possible to restructure the company. There were always was the possibility of spinoff of significant parts of the assets of the company anyway, and so that part of the plan probably is going to be effectuated one way or the other. But to step back and look at the question on a bigger sort of scale, it is not an unusual thing. I'm a litigation guy, but I know enough to be dangerous in the bankruptcy setting. And I think, in essence, when you're looking at an asset, a complex of assets, putting in the mix the question of labor relations and the possibility of a need for some form of restructuring of labor relations, and that's not just in the organized labor context, is certainly something that goes onto the short list. It's not an unusual thing that, in fact, labor relations is actually a core part of the reason why the company is in bankruptcy, part of the essential tools that are available to solve some of the company's structural problems may aim at solving that particular problem. But even if you don't have labor relations as a central part of the company's restructuring plan, things can go awry in the context of operation of the company in bankruptcy and then plans for taking it out. So I think from the standpoint of an investor looking at a distressed entity on the verge of or already into bankruptcy, it is probably on the short list. I'm not necessarily putting it in your top one or two or three, but it will certainly make your top 10 list as an essential question to ask from a diligence perspective. And from the standpoint of the company's planning, it is something that absolutely has to go into the restructuring plan.
Tim?
And I think I would add that, you know, one of the previous panels had W.R. Grace up there, and I suppose some of those restructurings, asbestos-related, maybe don't have headcount reductions. I personally have never been involved in a distressed company that didn't at some point have labor issues and headcount reductions as part of the restructuring plan. Whether that restructuring plan ultimately succeeded or not, you know, some of them did, some of them didn't. But headcounts were always a major part of it. When I mean, my tack on it, doing CRO work for middle markets is, I think you've got to balance that pressure across the entity. And I tend to start at the top of the organizational chart rather than the bottom, because I actually need those people down at the bottom of the organizational chart to do some work. And it's a lot easier to get them to do work if you're going to make a headcount reduction at the top. They can kind of buy into that philosophy first. So, you know, when I step in and some of my colleagues step in, it's not unusual to find one of the upper middle management guys. And if you want to call him a sacrificial lamb, go ahead. But it usually gets the organization's attention if you start there. And then you go down the organizational chart. Whether the rank and file is organized or it's not organized, you're going to have a better chance of success as far as getting that group to go along with the turn if they see that, you know, some of the management folks have borne a brunt of the pain as well.
Yeah, actually in the context of labor relations,
organized labor. That standard, the fair and equitable standard, is actually built into the code. And so both from the standpoint of trying to negotiate a deal and from the standpoint of ultimately, if you don't have a deal, trying to break the collective bargaining agreement, it's essential to be able to say, look, we're sharing the pain.
To me, there's no question that when you have significant either headcount reductions or shutdown of certain facilities, there's going to be a certain level of confusion. There's going to be a certain level of people focusing away from their jobs. It's so critical, even when you don't have that situation, for the communications to be clear, concise. There's nothing that I see in terms of a lot of these bankruptcies that end up creating, frankly, a lot of fees for us and for the rest of the professionals is when you don't communicate clearly and when you don't make it easier for the employees to understand what's happening and what impact there could be for him or her.
Well, and Stephen said that the personnel or people are probably a top 10, but it's really probably even higher than that. It is a top 3 or 4 because, in the simplest form, if you have people and you have a production line and you can't get them to produce efficiently and effectively, you're going to be out of business. And it's hard to put the emotion aside. And again, I'm not involved in Hostess and Twinkies, but to me, one of the telltale signs is where Judge Drain asked the mediator to come in on a Monday. And by Tuesday afternoon before Thanksgiving, so less than a week ago, the sides basically, I think, came back and said we're at an impasse. And after one day, Judge Drain accepted that and said, you know, I agree. And for a judge to accept that mediation only lasted a day or less rather than sending him back means how...
Well, to be fair, and I'm not here to really explain the ins and outs of Hostess, but to be fair, there was a very extensive negotiation process that led up to that, parallel negotiations, first with the Teamsters and second with the Bakers and some of the other unions. And actually, when you get to the 11-13 context, part of this is to bust a collective bargaining agreement. Part of the requirement to do that is to demonstrate that you have bargained in good faith, that you have provided information to the other side necessary to evaluate a proposal. And so you want to be in a position of saying, look, we've done our very best. So when you got to the point of, you know, mediation at the end of this process, it wasn't as if it were, the first time folks had ever looked at each other.
True. Steve, if I could ask you, was there a focus in the 11-13 discussions? Was it purely economics, or did you look at operational and work rule issues?
Well, this is not an unusual sort of thing. As you mentioned, the footprint of the company is always a part of the question going forward as part of the restructuring plan. What is it going to look like? What are the keepers and what are the sell it or dispose of it sort of questions?
And can it make money coming out?
Correct.
In the short and long term.
Correct. And so in the context of Hostess in particular, some of that did have to do with efficiency improvements that would require, the initiative was at the company level for certain sorts of improvements, but would require buy-in from the union, basically. So it's a mixture of, it's not just headcount, it's not just reducing headcount, it's changing operations. And as it happened with Hostess, part of the problem is literally dozens of locals for literally more than a dozen different unions, all with their own individual collective bargaining agreements. The Teamsters are actually easier for having had a national collective bargaining agreement that could be used as a model for the individual locals. But one other thing I was going to say about it's not just headcount is even at the executive level, right? To the extent that you need those folks to manage the bankruptcy process itself, and that is reporting to the court, reporting to constituents, et cetera, that may be a critical part of the ability of the company to function in bankruptcy. I worked on Tropicana, and in Tropicana, essentially, the company's books and records were like 19th century sort of stuff. These guys were sending checks by FedEx overnight to various locations to pay certain accounts payable. And in essence, there was a need to bring in a whole new accounting team to create an accounting and financial reporting system that didn't even exist. And without paying attention to those sorts of issues, who are you going to get to do that? And who are the people who are there who have essential information to bring it forward? That thing was not going to go ahead.
Right, being able to manage the infrastructure, and mm-hmm. gaming has its whole separate nuances in reporting too. Next question is, what do you do with the executive compensation retention issues, and what does the debtor need to focus on as a prior, some of the priority issues? Lorenzo, start with you.
I mean, to me, once again, this is an area that is critical in terms of how you communicate. It's critical in terms of being able to get significant both investor and bondholder support in terms of what you're doing, but it's also critical to get the comfort level and of employees as to what's going to happen. If you don't have your team ready to go in place, that, you know, you have very little chance in terms of success. The other part is you don't need the disruption. You don't need the focus being trained on this. And so where we've seen kind of successful this process being successfully done is when you see it articulated early and when you see kind of the process be a non-event. So with that.
The lawyers can probably speak more of this, but if you remember the last major bankruptcy reform act, basically said all retention, executive retention programs are null and void. You can't have them anymore. And I think we muddled along for a year or two, and then somebody came up with the idea, let's not call it retention, let's call it a bonus program, and set specific goals for management with regard to what the distressed entity is going to do. If that's going to be sell off, if that's going to improve earnings, improve EBITDA to some measurable goal, that's now allowable. There's elegance with that. I mean, that's how it should be. You shouldn't be paying someone to sit there and take up a chair for the next 6 months or a year. You ought to put specific goals down. So I think the emphasis changed correctly into putting specific goals down for the management team to reach. And if they can't, then the bonus isn't there.
You got to sell the idea, and you got to communicate it properly.
Well, you can usually get the lender, the guys that actually have to fund this. You can usually get the secured lenders to kind of buy into it and say, "Well, we got a better chance of getting you completely out of this thing if we can incentivize, you know, two or three or five of our key guys to get there." So you'll usually reluctantly get behind it.
It's also important to understand certain industries have certain nuances. So I worked as the CRO of a pharmaceutical company, which every person has FDA clearance. So we explained to the court, if you don't have a certain level of personnel, certain number of people, then you're going to be out of compliance and you can't ship the drugs. So understanding the nuances, and again, being able articulating that to the court, why you need a certain level of people. And it's important to me to incentivize them. Right. If they're going to be part of the people that are going to be there till the end, if they're only going to be there for a period, you need to put proper incentives in place. If you have a sale, right, you need usually a transition plan, and how you go about managing that transition again will be important to the buyer, the seller, and if it's a standalone reorganized company, where are you going?
Right, so I view it in part from the litigation perspective, where the issue essentially is credibility. At some point, some of those senior managers are going to be giving some form of testimony to the court in support of the restructuring plan, and certainly those folks are going to be talking to the affected constituents in the context of negotiation. And to the extent that you have transparency about the plan, what it is that these execs are working under, it's easier, or at least there's some enhanced certainty to deal with folks who everybody in the room knows what they're getting paid and what their targets are and how they are attached to the enterprise. If those things are open, and nobody knows for sure, there's plenty of suspicion about unstated deals, and even from the standpoint of the exec himself or herself, there is some uncertainty. Very natural attrition in the context of any bankruptcy proceeding. There are lots of folks who will walk out the door simply as a result of the uncertainty of the thing, and to the extent that you need those folks at the top to be the standard bearer, to give some assurance to the employees and other affected constituents, I do agree that an incentive system is necessary. But in addition to that, making it transparent actually makes it easier for everybody to work together.
Well, it'll make it. It just makes it work better. Because again, usually you have to if it's in court, you have to explain to the court, file a motion with the court what the incentives are, and again, it keeps everybody going in the same direction. The other thing too is if you have people that aren't comfortable working, you know, in a situation where they know it's going to be shut down or transferred and sold, you're better off just letting them leave. I mean, unless they become critical to the mission, but you're better off having people who are as comfortable as they're going to be, knowing that it's places shutting down, places going to be sold, places going to be in bankruptcy, because it's your best chance to get it to the end game, whatever that end game is. And sometimes it's a reorganization, sometimes it's just a flat out liquidation.
And obviously, from the standpoint of an investor, knowing the degree of stability at the top will give you some idea of the long-term chances for actual restructuring. Not that it's a clear sign, but in Hostess, within the first several months, the CEO, the chief of HR, who was dealing with the labor relations issues, and the general counsel all walked out the door.
And that also goes to why it's important to have a backup plan, as short term as it may be. And if you're going to incentivize and work to keep people, right, it's important that they're staying or termination in order to get the incentive is at the company's discretion. And I can say, at least certainly from the operating perspective, that if we're paying somebody a bonus or a stay incentive, the only time they get that is on the day they walk out the door, at our discretion. If we want to keep them, then it's that they stay till they can.
Could I just say one other thing on the credibility point? Working backwards from the petition date, there are plenty of circumstances where folks see the handwriting on the wall and begin to develop some concern about their long-term prospects. And there are some Ollie North style, it seemed like a good idea at the time, sort of initiatives to put together some form of unusual compensation to keep people in the driver's seat. Those things really need to be evaluated closely because they will become under scrutiny in the bankruptcy context. Preference, fraudulent transfer, and really just as a matter of credibility with the court.
Next on our list is facility shutdown, transfer of workers, some of the biggest concerns, benefits, cautions, Tim?
Well,
I mean, certainly from an investor and a board standpoint, the thoughts around a little question, the question of what we were talking about before is you've got to be conscious of warrant notice. Ultimately, management and certainly the board are going to be responsible for making that decision about issuing warrant notices in a proper time frame. Steve and the lawyers can speak directly to the requirements, but, you know, roundabout, it's 100 people. If there's 100 people there and you're going to let 50% of them go, you're going to need to issue warrant notices. Now, there's a lot more to it than that. And there's state underlying state statutes that have to follow that too. But if you are in a board capacity, you need to be conscious of that. The ramifications are you end up paying somebody for 60 days of not working along with benefits. I guess if you think that's onerous, you should try and close down a plant in Canada where some of the social costs can run into. For an employee that a rank and file employee that might have been there 10 or 12 years can run into 24 months of compensation with benefits. So, you know, while there are some would be considered onerous issues with regard to shutting down a facility, namely the warrant notices, I think you want to get out ahead of that as far as possible, make sure you understand it, and make sure you, maybe wrong terminology here, but pull the trigger early enough in that notice period so you don't expose yourself to that, and make sure you understand what the state statute is as well.
Pass, Stephen. This
is in practical terms, in a lot of circumstances, you know, companies know that they are sliding in the direction of some form of restructuring, and very often they get professional assistance, financial advisors who will work with them on formulating a plan for restructuring, first aimed at some sort of voluntary out-of-bankruptcy solution, and ultimately, if you can, some form of prepackaged solution with major constituents sufficient to confirm the plan. That process very often includes the footprint question, the headcount question, and brings to the fore the question of do we have collective bargaining agreement obligations that will be affected by the changes, and this issue, the warrant notice sort of question. And again, you know, I'm bad at estimating level of priority, but that is one of those things that however you prioritize it, you know at that point when you've gone through the process of getting financial advice about restructuring that there's some portion of the anticipated restructuring that will have an impact on labor. It's so clear and stark in mind, and yet people somehow manage to ignore the warrant issue. Now, fairly, part of the concern is to prematurely accelerate the process. You send out a warrant notice, and you're not actually ready for bankruptcy, well, you may actually make it more likely as a result of the message to all of your affected constituents.
You're going to accelerate the trade. The trade's going to get noticed.
Right.
Well, it's public information.
Right. And not unusually, the trades start stretching their payments.
Right.
And that causes problems as well.
Well, also, too, other than in each state has its own interpretations, the wrong word, but it's important to understand the law by state, and if you do send it out too early, it could and it most likely will shut down and jeopardize the business. So understanding the timeline and planning is, again, as important as anything. And healthcare, if you're involved in nursing homes or hospitals, they have not necessarily a WARN Act provision, but they do. But theirs is also even more complicated because in certain states, like Pennsylvania, you have to keep the hospital open for, I believe, it's 90 days. And open means you got to have an emergency room. So you got the ER has to be staffed around the clock. So if one person comes, you still have to have that staff. So understanding the industry and the state laws is going to be critical upon, you know, whether it's, again, a reorganization or liquidation, and being able to articulate to the court is going to be critical. Because in the case that we were in, articulating to the court that by having to keep it open and staffed, that everybody would be wiped out came as that anything better than that ongoing liquidation was a better alternative.
Well, even in liquidation, you know, having some plan, having some schedule for the events that have to occur, it's sort of like critical path analysis in getting things done. One thing leads to another, and so being cognizant of the steps that are likely to be taken, and then putting some priority on which ones have to be taken first and where the resources need to be applied.
And Tim, anything?
The only thing I think I'd add to that, in the context of a restructuring, again, you've got to step back and say, if you're going to rationalize the footprint here, you may have this on multi-locations. So it's a location-by-location basis. The board needs to make sure that your advisors and the legal team are addressing that and getting out in front of it. Although I will tell you from a practical standpoint, it's very difficult to shut down any sizable company in a 60-day period of time. So put that in your planning metrics as you're rationalizing a footprint from a location standpoint, but recognize 60 days isn't that onerous a period to wind down a company, certainly a manufacturing company. You're going to have to sell off equipment. You're going to have to liquidate inventory. You're going to have some run out of some processes. So kind of build that in, and a lot of times what we do is build it in on a floating basis to say, okay, if the sale process falls apart here for this particular plan, that will, and back to the critical path analysis, that will generate our requirement for a WARN notice, and we'll begin the process at that point. The other thing is that the workforce is kind of aware of what's happening. You're telling them you're going through a process, we're going to try and sell a certain location, and while you're not going to come out and tell them there's a WARN notice if it fails, everybody kind of gets the handwriting on the wall and they're a little bit prepared for it. It's an unusual circumstance, and I've done a couple of them, but the usual circumstance where you just do that and send everybody home and, you know, WARN liability kicks in. From a practical standpoint, if a board is managing the process well enough, you should be out ahead of it to be able to meet those 60-day requirements.
Just a couple of comments, and not entirely facility shutdown, but more location shutdowns. What I've seen done very well in the context of retail is when really the firm manages exactly when they're communicating. In cases like Kmart, they always waited until 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock to file their motions to the court as to what locations they were shutting down. And we never even got the pleading until after 6 o'clock that needed to be overnighted to 8,000 people that night. But in terms of how you communicate to employees, to everybody else, and through the media, you know, you really got to manage that very carefully. That's particularly in larger cases.
Yeah, it's a cliche, but how you manage it, right, is going to be critical to the success, to the timing, to hitting budgets and forecasts. If you're going to shut down a facility, right, but not the business, how do you manage that shutdown? Do you need 24-hour around-the-clock security, right? Because if you have a dissident group, right, sometimes you need it just to send a message, right? And I just, again, at the pharmaceutical company, you know, we had people that would came in after the shutdown was announced and started egging the cars in the parking lot because we were running 2 and 3 shifts, and the day after it happened, because, you know, some of the employees, again, the line workers, the soldiers had nothing to do primarily with the issues, is we got approval for the estate to pay for the cars cleanup, to put guards on the property so to not have it happen again, and how to deal with it. So how do you manage the process is critical. Look in the communications, because we always say that people are smarter than we're all given credit for. And if you tell them, right, the worst thing in one of the worst things in a wind down, in a liquidation, in a 363, in anything, is the unknown. People can deal with the known. They may not like it, right? Nobody likes to lose their jobs, but they can deal with it better than if they get, I don't know. So having the plan and the communication is going to be critical.
I don't know whether the metaphor works, but anybody see Moneyball, where he explains how you fire a player? You know, you have a choice between shooting him in the gut and shooting him in the head. Better to shoot him in the head because he knows that's it. It's over. And so to a degree, these rumors, and they will be magnified by the social media universe, it's a reality. The emotional element of the thing will affect the politics of the thing, especially in the context of organized labor. They have a constituency they have to report to. Ultimately, they can be voted out of office. And so paying attention to the fact that even if you say nothing, you are communicating in some regard. Failure to identify at least the outline of the plan constitutes some kind of confirmation of uncertainty and creates a void that will be filled with other voices.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, guys like Rob and I are kind of like the Darth Vaders. When we walk into a middle market company, it's not long before everybody in the entity knows, gee, there's a guy here that's called a CRO, or he's the financial advisor. So you've got to communicate to the whole workforce fairly quickly that there is going to be change. We don't know exactly what that change looks like right now, but I agree with Steve. The last thing you want to do is just let it hang out there and say, you know, there's a bunch of advisors running around here, there's some lawyers running around here, and everybody in the plant's all upset about it. Things just kind of shut down. You've got a couple of days after you make announcements where things will come back down, but the third or fourth day, it all comes back up again. People resolve themselves with the fact that this is what's going to happen. So I agree with you. You got to, you know, to the extent you can communicate, you've got to communicate. If you even need to soft pedal it and say, we're not sure what's going to happen, there's going to be changes, things are not going to be the same, that's at least enough to placate some of the fears in the rank and file that, you know, we're not going to be here tomorrow. Give them some comfort that we're going to be around for a little bit, and that, you know, change is a good thing as opposed to the unknown.
One other emotional issue, and it harkens back some to the executive retention issue, is in some instances the politics of the thing are affected by who are the folks involved in the negotiations and in the communications. No offense to friends who are CROs, but very typically the labor force will view them as outsiders who don't know the industry, don't know the specifics of the company, and may be much more comfortable speaking to some folks that they've negotiated with in the past. Now, there are some circumstances where they pretty much just loathe the people that they've negotiated with in the past. And those are soft sort of facts that, from the standpoint of an investor, you might want to know about. It's the kind of thing that if you're trying to handicap the possibility for some form of labor restructuring is not exactly a wild card, but it's something on which there aren't really hard metrics, but it may have as much impact on the process as anything else.
Well, and it's important to understand that before you walk into the negotiating session, then after. Right, you need to. If you're new, if you're the new gunslinger like Tim and myself or Lorenzo, it's better to know who's respected and who's less than respected before you walk in. Because if it's somebody that another side respects, it's best to have them in the room. because it gives credibility. At the same time, if it's somebody that the other side loathes, which regardless of what side it's on, better they step no part into the room. And again, how you manage that process will be critical, even though it's a soft, quote unquote, a soft concern, a soft issue. It'll lay the foundation for, you know, the future success and future failure of it. So as we wind down, we'll start. Tim, biggest things you've seen done best, things you've seen, biggest mistakes you desperately want to avoid?
You know, I always tend to gravitate to the negative, so I'll go with the worst. Just about a year to the day, we were brought in as FAs to a company that had filed Tuesday before Thanksgiving. And they filed completely unprepared, no plan, no dip, due to the senior lender, working capital lender, basically pulling the line the Friday before. And not only pulling the line, but pulling back payroll commitment that they had made, such that all of the employees' checks bounced. It was in a southern state, so many of these were pretty low-wage folks, didn't even have checking accounts, went to grocery stores, went to liquor stores, gas stations, cashed their check, only to have it bounce two or three days after the fact. I will tell you that getting that workforce back up to speed and getting them back producing was a very, very difficult task. So from a secured lender standpoint, be conscious, even though emotions, even on a secured lender standpoint, will sometimes get a bit overheated, don't do something precipitous that you're going to regret. There are, as I said before, there are very few organizations that you're going to maximize value by snapping your finger and closing the door and liquidating. It's going to take some time to liquidate out a business, whether that be collecting the accounts, running the inventory out, just getting the books and records. Do it in an orderly manner. Don't do it in a precipitate basis. And communicate with the workforce. Don't do it, you know, as this lender chose to do.
Now, my comment would be, respect to certain notices that end up going to employees or consumers, you've got to be really careful. I think among the biggest problems we see is sometimes when firms will take a template that looks great, it can be properly used, but in the context of their employees or consumers, it just it will create confusion. You know, if you're having something go to employees and consumers, really limit the level of legal jargon that's in there. Among the probably the biggest issues that we've seen when you don't do that, I should tell you, is that you see the costs really spiral. We get lots of calls. If we're getting lots of calls from your employees, that means they're really not focusing on their job. In terms of your vendors, you know, all that dislocation is just not a healthy way to kind of progress and meet your goals. Among the biggest things in terms of biggest mistakes that I've probably seen are bar dates for professionals that was being sent to 60,000 physicians. Well, our call center lit up because they weren't sure if they were professionals or not. Something like 10,000 of them actually filed claims. They all needed to be objected to. So that's the kinds of things that you almost need to step back when you're dealing with folks that are not usually in the process and think about doing something different. The things that I've seen done really well, we had a case where there was, I think, 30,000 refund creditors from infomercials. They were not going to, it was questionable whether they were going to be impaired. It made no sense to send them a big, thick disclosure statement. Under 1129, you can do a summary disclosure statement for a subset, which is what got done for them, something that explained it in clear, concise English so they could really understand what was going on. Significantly less cost, and there was really very little impact to that creditor body. So that's among the things that I would kind of suggest and recommend.
Right. How do you make the greatest impact at the least cost? You know, and following up something that Tim did on his story where we had that too, where the lender said they'll honor the payroll and they didn't in places where there weren't a lot of bank accounts and not a lot of wealth. So it was, the secured facility was $30 million. And once we got past that point, we convinced the lender to fund it, to fund for anybody that proved they had a return check, right, to fund the bounce check fee, right? And you think about it, you have a $30 million credit facility, so we've been able to make some peace, right? If there's $25 in 1,000 checks, you're talking about $25,000 to gain back some goodwill, and I can't tell you, you know, what a small modicum commitment that did, that transitioned the whole workforce and gaining back some of the credibility that had been crushed when you walk up to the window and, oh, by the way, your check is no good, right? So how do you make those kinds of impacts? And also when you talk about planning and documentation and trying to carve the emotion out of it, right, which is almost impossible but equally critical, right? So, and again, and everybody's heard it, but when you're typing in the email, probably good to catch your breath before you hit send and say, do you really want to say what you're sending, and is it going to come out that way because nobody's there on the other end to interpret it?
I can tell you about one of my least happy days in bankruptcy court. I don't quite know what too clever by half means, but I think this comes close to that example. In the Dana case, fortunately, this didn't prevent the case from being confirmed, but early on, the company had a key employee retention program, and they decided when they were in bankruptcy basically to just rewrite it as an incentive program. All of that ended up being spread on the record, because with the discovery process, you will have access to information, depositions, et cetera. Not to mention, executive compensation, I think, is one of those things that receives a high level of attention, both from labor groups and from the Unsecured Creditors Committee. They, if there's one thing that they look at, it's fees for professionals, and in this case, executives. And ultimately, we're in front of Judge Liflin, argued the thing for probably an hour and change, and then Judge Liflin said to us, are you all done? We said, yeah. And he proceeded to read his opinion into the record, which obviously he had written before we got there. And the line that makes me most uncomfortable even today is, if it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, it's a duck. And so attempting to take a CURP and transmogrify it into an incentive program turned out to be a bad idea from the get-go. Starting over would have been the better solution under those circumstances. As I say, it turned out to be a hiccup in the overall completion of the Dana case, but what seemed like a good idea proved to be not so in retrospect.
With that, we'll have time for a question, but any? All right, thank you.
Thank you. Good job. She's moving.